there is not, as far as a fungus is concerned, awfully much nutritionally sound material around. And so a question related to what they're doing there is, can they get hold of nutrients when they are there? You know, this is a very nutrient-poor environment. And we have, with some of the fungi which I've talked about already, we've just started to look at their growth and development under what is known as oligotrophic conditions. In other words, very nutrient-poor conditions. And that is becoming very revealing. So the story which I'm telling you now, I might want to change my mind next week, slightly, in that I think we've implied that we've got the latent propagules dotted around, and maybe they're the same genotype, in which case, later on, when conditions are suitable, they will germinate, develop as mycelia, and intermingle. But I think perhaps there might be, in certain circumstances, anyway, with some of the fungi, particularly with the ascomycetes, I think it may well be that we don't just have propagules there, but we have very, very sparse mycelia, even just the odd fungal hypha. If we have very nutrient poor conditions and if oxygenation has begun to be increased. So I think the story which I'm telling you now is the story which I'd have told you not awfully long ago, but I think we should extend that now to think that we don't just have these propagules, but once aeration is beginning, we start to get very fine hyphae developing as well. So you can see that these things can develop even more quickly than one might have thought of to start with. That's sort of gone on a bit from your question, but it's on the same sort of track.
Russell Ball, London Tree Officers Association. Have you calculated threshold values for decreasing moisture content in wood at which the propagules kick in and start infecting wood? And also, do you ever see a day whereby we can actually calculate pruning regimes, i.e. number, percentage of crown reduction, percentage of crown thinning, which will affect the flow rates within wood with regard to the point at which a propagule will become active within wood tissue?
Well, the answer to the first part of the question is no, we haven't worked out threshold values because we've only so far, being mere mortals, managed to work with about five different drying regimes at a time. But I guess theoretically the time might come when you could work out how much canopy you could remove or how little. But theoretically, I can't see that really in practice you could, because there are so many other variables involved, aren't there? It's not just removing canopy, is it? It's what the weather is doing today, tomorrow, the next day. It's what it's done 6 months in the past. It's to do with how much water there is in the soil water deficit, and all these sorts of things as well. So, I mean, I guess theoretically you could do this, and maybe you can get some rules of thumb in practice. And I guess probably for most of you, rules of thumb would do very nicely. But I don't think you could ever be very precise because of the huge number of variables involved. But yes, maybe we could get rules of thumb one day before too long.
There has been a debate, and I think it's still current, about... and would appreciate your comments on this. If we see stress in a tree or anticipate stress in a tree, perhaps because we anticipate some root severance or some interruption to its moisture, either availability or capturing capacity, we have in the past, or there has been a practice, to remove branches before they actually naturally die off. Would you see any aspect of your work giving us guidance as to whether we think it would be better to let them die than prune them off, or prune them off before they die?
Well, it's going to be a woolly answer again, because it's going to depend upon the conditions. But I think, as you'll see in a minute from the next part of the talk, in some circumstances it was absolutely absolutely valuable to remove canopy, to remove that pulling force on water, in other words, from draining out the system, if you like. You'll have to wait and see the next bit that I'm going to talk on about strip cankers. Maybe when we go around this afternoon, I think you'll see that. But I think you'll see that, you know, the pulling force can very rapidly empty, if you like, a cylinder of wood and allow things to develop. I think the answer's going to change depending on conditions, really.
Okay.
I mean, there are obviously some circumstances where that would be true.
Thank you.
Holmes contractor. I wonder, during your work, can you shed any light on Summer Branch Drop then and its relationship to this water uptake?
No.
Thank you.
Right, would you like to resume?
Right, can we have the curtains drawn again, please? That wasn't meant to be rude, but it's something which is always leaping into my mind, and I really don't have any comments on that. Okay, so for the second part of this talk, I want to tell you a little bit about strip cankers on beech trees. And this work has been done in the last 3 or 4 years by a research student of mine and jointly supervised by David Lonsdale, whom you all know. The research student was Stephen Hendry, and I hoped he'd be here to answer all the detailed questions, but we've had a mad telephone message to say that he's not arriving for whatever reason, I don't know. You've obviously frightened him off. But let me tell you all that I can about these strip cankers, although I can't promise to answer any very detailed questions necessarily at the end. So you've probably seen strip cankers on beach, and Alan showed a photograph early on. And I think whilst you may have seen lots of different fruit bodies associated with strip cankers, the fungi which are actually directly involved with them or found very early on in the development of strip cankers are Eutypus spinosa and Viscognioxia numularia, which we probably know better as Hypoxylon numularium. So if I keep accidentally switching into Hypoxylon numularium, please forgive me. These strip cankers on beech, which are very large strips of dead wood, usually covered with a fungal stromata of one of these two species, became evident in 1977, again in 1984, and again in 1991. And that should be ringing some bells to some of you already. Let's have a little bit of a look at these strip cankers. Now, they're awfully difficult, as Alan already pointed out, to photograph, but you can just about make out a large strip canker extending for a very long way into the canopy of this large beech tree. And this particular one is of Eutypa spinosa. Here's the stromata of Eutypa. You can see very healthy, very large osteoles on the fruit bodies. Here is an ascus containing 8 ascus spores, very characteristically shaped. That's in a fully hydrated condition. And here is a much more squiggly one, which is begin to dry up. And again, this will be, when it rains, rehydrated very easily into the sort which you've just seen previously. This is a section through a trunk, a beech trunk. This part of the wood is still functional. This is the canker region here. And in this region here, we have Eutypa. In all of this darkened region here, we have bacterial wet wood, which is quite interesting because every canker which had Eutypa in also had, the tree had bacterial wet wood present. And this is a particularly interesting section because you can just about make out a very faint line here, maybe not too clear for those of you at the back, but it's really rather like a tide mark in the bath. The wet wood originally was present up to this line, and then with aeration of these tissues here, the wet wood has, well, become dry wood, so to speak. Also interesting here, we've got Ustulina in various different regions. So this was a section through a trunk relatively low down, and the Ustulina had come in the usual way from the bottom up. You can see that since the canker developed, there is 1 year's worth of more recent growth of this tree. This is a section higher up. Again, you can see extra growth. Here we've got 2 different individuals of Eutypa spinosa, Again, bacterial wet wood. And this time in the middle, we got Ganoderma, which is rather nice. So we've got lots of complicating issues here, but the major organism is associated with the canker is, in this case, Euterpes spinosa. And again, if we do the pairings from isolates made from these regions, pair them up, we find we have huge long individuals, very many metres, dozens of metres in some cases. I think the record is a good 12 or so metres. And then again, we've got another type of strip canker here. This is the one produced by Bisognioxia numularia. You can see the stromata here. Here it is again. You can see the edge of the canker, the callus. These are the asci containing ascospores. Quite a nice picture because you've got ascospores, look, in different stages of development. Immature ones getting more mature and fully mature there. And it's rather nice as well because there's a periphysis. This time a section through a trunk. So the canker is here. There's some new growth there. We've got the Bisognioxia in this region, well, all of this region here. But this is really a rather messy section, isn't it? Look at this horrible black mess, this black stained region. This black stained region, in fact, also contains Bisognioxia, but not alone. And this is unusual because more often than not, these long individuals we've showed you are pure cultures. Only one fungus is present within these huge great decay columns, but not in this case. We have Bisognioxia and Hypoxylum purpureum. So that's quite a rare occurrence. And we'll come back to thinking why that might be in a moment. And just to demonstrate, these are isolates taken from that stained region. And what happened was very quickly Bisognioxia grew out from each of these four isolates, filled the plates. But since we usually leave our plates hanging around for rather a long time, probably through laziness and not good housekeeping, after rather more 2 or 3 weeks or so, out of the bits of wood, suddenly something else began to creep. And this is the Hypoxylon purpureum. And for the benefit of the front row, it isn't a contaminant. Just to show you again the extent of these huge, great, long individuals. BN1 is the Bisognioxia, still going up here. You'll also see there's another individual there, indicated by B2. And the individual H represents the Hypoxylon purpureum. So some regions where we've got pure cultures of Bisognioxia, some regions where we've got Bisognioxia and Hypoxylon purpureum. Now, if we look at the water contents of these different regions, this again gives us clues as to what's going on. Let's take this one. Now, I haven't read these data, so I hope this isn't going to let me down. Right, region one, if you can remember back from the last diagram, this is where we have Bisognioxia alone. Region two is where we had Bisognioxia and Hypoxylon purpureum, those horrible black-stained areas. And then region 3 is the functional sapwood. And if we just look across to the actual water contents of these regions, sorry to throw numbers at you, especially so near lunch, the points you can see are that region number 1, just there, is quite dry. Region number 3, there, this is the sapwood, is the sort of water content you'd expect in sapwood. So region number 1 is drier than the sapwood, so this is all the usual story. The wood has dried out, and hence we've got the Euterpa, etc. But look at region number 2, where we have those horrible black patches. Much higher figures. Much higher than the region with Bisognioxia alone. much higher than the sapwood. I indicated there's a degree of significance there if we want to go into statistics, which I'm sure we don't, but they're very significantly different. So very, very wet, wetter than the sapwood itself. How can it be wetter than the sapwood itself? That's interesting, isn't it? So the point here then is that we only get these two fungi developing together when the water is very, when the wood is very, very wet. How does it become so wet? And I don't know the answer to that. Fungi themselves, as they're decaying wood, obviously produce metabolic water, which could increase the water content. But surely this alone can't be the answer. Maybe the tree itself is, for some reason, shunting water into these regions. And really, this is all hypothesis. I don't know the answer. It's an interesting point. I think it's very important. Something very important is going on here, but I can't tell you any more of it for now. We can just summarise these things again. The bottom plots here are water content and density of sapwood. Let me just check. The squares are the water content here. The triangles are the density. As we go up the tree with height. So no change, really. Just a few fluctuations here and there in healthy, functional wood. But look at this plot here, which is the plot in the canker region. The density of the wood in the canker region increases. In other words, there's more mass in the cankered region, particularly in those stained regions. So how is that coming about? Is it that the tree is doing something here? There's more mass there than could possibly be attributed to fungal mycelia, much more. So is the tree doing something in that region? Probably. And look at the water content plot again with height. You can see that it dries down, and that's where we've just got the cankers with the Biscogne auxia, and then higher up it increases madly, which we've already seen, associated with those horrible black stained regions. So there are some very intriguing things going on here, and to be honest, you're as wise as I am as to what they are. All right, let's move away from water for 10 seconds at any rate. I just want to show you that the trees which tend to get strip cankers are the biggest trees, usually the trees of greatest girth on a plot. So this just represents the number of trees up here. These black lines are all of the trees present on the site. That's the distribution of size classes, diameter at breast height. This hatched region, though, represents the trees which are cankered. It represents the percentage cankering. So you can see that you get strip cankers on the larger trees. This is a bit naughty. Don't take too much notice of this, because this obviously only represents one tree. But nonetheless, you can see that the rest of this distribution shows that you tend to get strip cankers on the larger trees. Where else do you get these strip cankers? Can we say anything about the distribution of these things? Well, this is a forest plot, and there were bridleways up the edges here. The black blobs represent trees with cankers, and the open blobs represent trees without cankers. And that is a significant distribution. Clearly the canker trees around the outsides of those plots. So why? What is it that is allowing cankers to develop on these trees around the outsides? Now again, we can't be categorical about this. It's quite clear that the soil in these regions is very well compacted because of the bridleways, and presumably the water getting into the soil is much less in these regions. Also, these trees, you will remember, are much bigger. And, of course, they're much bigger because they're on the edge of the plot. So we've got this wretched cause and consequence problem, as ever. So, again, really, I can't say why, in all confidence, they're there. But They clearly are distributed around the edge of the plots on the larger trees. And I think you'll find in a minute it's probably going to be to do with water. Everything is so far, isn't it? OK. Now, on the first slide that I showed you, which said when we get strip cankers, you'll see that we had them in 1977, 1984, 1990, whatever it was. And I said that you'll probably recognise the significance of this straight away. If you can remember, like me, to what was happening in 1977, or more particularly in 1976, 1976 was the real big drought year, wasn't it? And you can see it quite clearly from these MET data. This is a plot of rainfall for the years around 1976-77. And remember back with me, we didn't have awfully much rain in 1976 in the summer. Moreover, it was quite low at lots of times in 1975 as well. And if we look at the Met Office data for soil moisture deficit, which is calculated in a complicated way, the bigger these bars mean, the more water, the harder it is for a tree to get hold of water, the higher the deficit. An important point to note is that even in the winter of 75-76, there was a water deficit. Now, that is very rare, you can see from other plots. Don't take any notice of this end one, because the Met Office, in all their wisdom, suddenly decided that they'd calculate water deficit by a totally different formula. And as you might guess, it comes up with totally different answers, which are not comparable, so just ignore that. But you can see there's a huge water deficit. And again, if we looked at the plots for the years preceding the appearance of strip cankers later on, we'd find that there was always water deficit in the preceding seasons. Now, enough about water. I'd just like to say a very little about the intimate relationship between fungi and host. I hinted at this at the end of the first part of the talk. Let's have a look at it for the canker fungi and for beach cells, the beach tissue. Now, what Stephen did in these experiments was he grew beach callus in artificial culture, and then he exposed those beach callus cultures to either extracts of various of the fungi which he'd isolated from trees, or to the fungi themselves, or as controls, to nothing. And let's start at the one side of this intimate relationship by looking at how the callus cells affect the fungi. We always think about the fungi affecting trees, don't we? Well, remember, you can have effects in the other direction also. And I've just listed here, but we'll see it much more dramatically in a minute in some photographs, I've listed here the range of fungi that Stephen looked at. He grew them without callus and measured the growth rate, the extension rate of fungi, and he measured them with callus. And let's just look at two or three important species. Here is Eutypa spinosa, without callus, low growth rate. Look at it with callus. Phenomenally different, isn't it? It bombs along like nobody's business when there's callus present. So does Biscoglioxia nummularia. On the other hand, look at poor Hypoxylon purpureum. As soon as we have callus around, its growth rate slows dramatically. So there clearly is a relationship between the presence of callus and what the fungi are doing. Let's just show you this. Eutypa spinosa growing on its own. It's got to about there. Eutypa spinosa growing with beach callus. This plate was incubated for exactly the same time as the previous one. Look, it's bombed all over there. Look how much healthier it is. Biscoglioxia nummularia growing without callus. And here with callus, again, it's romped over the plate. And you'll also notice that it looks very much healthier. And incidentally, look, away from the callus, you've got this crenellated margin, which again you had in the absence of callus. So the beach callus, the beach cells, are affecting not only the growth, but also the morphology of the fungus. And I'd be prepared to guess that not only is the morphology of the fungus being affected, but so also is the physiology. Hypoxylon purpureum. without callus, look, right over the plate. With callus, poor little thing has been sent right backwards. Please don't think that that's mycelium. It isn't. It's just that Stephen photographed this with the lid on the plate, and that's the light reflecting. Okay, so you can clearly see then beach cells affect the growth of fungi. What about the other way round? Do the fungi affect the beach cells? Now, don't be panicky by this. It's very simple what I want to tell you, but it's really to remind me what happened more than anything. This illustrates whether callus is formed in the presence of filtrates from the fungus. In other words, in the presence of something which the fungus has produced. And the H's just represent whether there were plant hormones present. It doesn't matter. The control, the callus grew beautifully. We've got different concentrations of culture filtrate here. This is really concentrated, and this is getting weaker and weaker. You'll notice that with very concentrated filtrate of all the fungi Stephen used, there was no callus growth. But look, with Bisgogneauxia nummularia, with Hypoxylum fragiforme, there is callus growth when the filtrates from those two fungi have been added at weaker concentrations, but not when Hypoxylum purpureum is added. So clearly, filtrates from fungi, in other words, products of fungal metabolism, actually can affect whether beech cells grow. And you'll notice at those weak concentrations, beech cells did grow. Let's look at that in a little bit more detail. With the Bisgogneauxia nummularia, at the weak concentrations of filtrate, you'll notice that, in fact, the beech cells grow much more. They put on much more weight than the controls did. The same is also true with Hypoxylum fragiforme. So this time we're saying that the fungus affects the growth of the beech cells. At high concentrations, the beech cells die, but at lower concentrations, they're stimulated to grow even more than they would have otherwise done. And this is also very clearly shown in a field experiment where Stephen inoculated Bisgogneauxia into... It was obviously a standing beech tree at the time. He's felled it since. But look at this region here associated underneath. Underneath there, we've got the Bisgogneauxia. But look at the extra growth produced by the tree when that fungus is present. It's quite dramatic. And you can see this quite clearly from the section which Stephen took from that particular tree. This is all of the growth, the extra growth of cells in the region where the fungus was present, compared to very little over there in the, away from the sphere of influence of the fungus. Right, you'll be glad, very glad, because I know you're desperate for lunch now. You'll be glad to know that my last point is coming now. At the end of the last talk, I said, what form were these propagules in? And that Alan and I really had a gut feeling from the word go that they probably might well be yeast-like forms. But it's very hard to force fungi to change from a mycelium to a yeast to prove that this is the case. We struggled for years with this. And then, blow me, if when we grew some of the fungi on plant tissue culture medium, straight away, chains of yeast-like cells were formed. This is Hypoxylum purpureum. And, of course, what does plant culture conditions have in it that might cause such growth? And, of course, there are plant hormones. So it looks very much as if plant hormones trigger the production of yeast-like cells in fungi. So again, there is this intimate relationship of plant affecting fungus as well as fungus affecting plant. And this is in Bisgogneauxia. You can see peculiar apical swellings which were present only when growing on the plant tissue culture medium. So I think we're beginning to get on the way to knowing a little bit about what these propagules are and what causes them of form. So back to my original question, did it fall or was it pushed? Is fungal decay an inside job? Well, it obviously is an inside job, but I think what I was meaning you to think of here was this business of latency. But what about the did it fall or was it pushed bit? Well, that's back to one of the questions that Alan was asking earlier about cause and effect. Are these things pathogens or not? It's quite clear that these things develop only as results of water stress, but that in fact the answer is not clear-cut at all, and that you've got all sorts of circular things going on. And I'd just like to point out to you that I'm really pleased to see such a huge audience interested in these talks, probably less interested now you've had the dubious pleasure of listening to me. But I'm always looking through the literature, trying to find out what other people are doing, all sorts of literature, and I find, in fact, that there are all sorts of other people who are interested in the effect of water on trees and tree health. I was looking in one of the books of my four-year-old the other night, and I saw this, but I don't think they've got quite the right idea. Thank you very much for your patience.